perception is about when other people have a different reality to you. It's outside of your reality. So you think one thing's happening. And you might think you've delivered clear, concise, and really concrete communication, but the other person's perception might be completely different. The best communication for me, just again, if you see it, you say it, you never leave it. So whatever you're assuming that something's taking place, you're leaving yourself wide open for the communication to fail.
Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Steph Holloway. She is founder of Elemental Potential. Welcome, Steph.
Hi, thanks for having me on your podcast, Jen.
Oh, I am so excited to chat with you today, Steph. So let's get going right away and let's have you talk a little bit about what you do so that folks can get to know you a little bit better. And then we'll dive into some other stuff about compassionate communication and assertiveness and other related topics. But first things first, tell us about Elemental Potential. What's your mission?
Okay. Oh my goodness. This in the end comes down to a really simple answer for me. When people ask me that question, I just normally say to help people be better communicators. So I find that often people just need perspective and insight into their own communication style first. And quite often they don't realize how they express themselves and what they invite into their world and what they send out to the world with their communication. So I just see myself as that kind of voice of reason some days, and someone to just give them a bit of an edge with the communication they're using in life.
All right, got it. And so what kind of help do you typically provide? Would you identify yourself as a consultant, a coach, an author, a writer, a little bit of all of the above?
I would say a little bit of all of that above, because the range of businesses that I work with are really diverse. I've worked with well over 10,000 individual people now and about 1,200 businesses around the world. And it's very diverse. So that can be tech, media, retail, sales, healthcare, engineering. But what I've found, what kind of links them all, no matter what business I'm going into, is that I find people can be incredibly talented, super talented at what they do. But that doesn't always correlate to being an effective communicator in terms of what they're either sending out or what they're receiving in. So my passion, I suppose, lies in the uncovering of that and why people do communicate in a certain way. So I've kind of spent the last 8 years trying to re-educate people and show them that whatever you're learning, whatever your past learning is from your communication style, you can change that whenever you want. You know, all communication is learned, so it can be unlearned.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love, one of the reasons why I was excited to talk with you again and talk with you more is because you have experience in so many different industries, including tech. So sometimes on the podcast, I interview folks who are specifically, you know, within the tech industry, and that's been their experience. But I think it's so important for that perspective to take a step back and say, okay, how might the tech industry be different, but also how might it be the same as other industries, especially in terms of the people stuff? And certainly communication definitely falls under that umbrella of people stuff. So I'm curious, this is kind of an off-the-cuff question, but it came up as you were talking about your experience, Steph, that have you noticed when you take a look back and you compare the people who you've worked with in the tech industry compared to other industries, have you noticed similarities, differences, or not so much?
The common similarities for all the businesses are that it actually depends on the tipping points of communication styles within a team or within a business. So it's not so much industry specific. And I guess the tech industry would be the same as any other industry. You know, communication is a pain point for people, whatever the industry is. And you're often at the mercy of other people within a team. So I've been doing a lot of talks this year globally about where those tipping points are. Even when I did yesterday, we found out that the balance was really skewed. So what I mean by that is if there's too many passive people in a team or too many assertives, you throw in a couple of aggressives or passive aggressives, and you've really got a different communication mix that isn't nice for some people that are in that team. So you're kind of at the mercy of other people, I guess, their communication style, no matter what the industry is. And the tech industry would be no different in that.
Okay. And when you say tipping points, what do you mean by that exactly?
So a really great tipping point here in New Zealand seems to be 4 passive people to 1 assertive person, and ideally no passive aggressive people at all, because those are your people that are kind of your glass half full people, your classic whingers. They will often tell the person that can take no action on what they're whinging about, so nothing ever gets resolved. So the tipping point really comes where the balance is kind of skewed in the wrong favor, and there's a lot of enablement for passive aggressive people and aggressive people to survive in teams. So my mission on this planet is definitely to try and figure out how to lessen that impact of people that are running at that very low energy level in teams, regardless of the business. I just see the whole thing as the pure mechanics of communication most days, honestly. When I go into businesses, it's very easy to spot where the balance is skewed, how many people are running on different styles, and what that means for the other people around them.
Okay, so this is really interesting. So you mentioned, for example, one good ratio that you found is 4 to 1. Was it 4 passive to 1 assertive?
4 passive to 1 assertives. So, but of course, there's a lot of people in teams that actually don't realize they're compassionately assertive. So in a team of 14 I dealt with yesterday, for example, there was 2 people in the room that actually didn't realize they were compassionately assertive, because for most people, they don't recognize that label. They've never heard of it before. So they just think they might be one thing or another. But in actual fact, once you throw through a few compassionate assertives into a team as well, normally the balance is kind of corrected a little bit, because you've got that reason in there, people that are looking for the win-win, that work on collaboration. Mm-hmm. It all kind of comes together if you've got the right mix.
Okay. And so I've heard a lot of categories here. So we have passive, we have assertive, compassionate, assertive, aggressive, passive aggressive. Is this a categorization that you came up with, or is this borrowing from somebody else?
The 4 main communication styles, which are passive aggressive, assertive, and passive aggressive, which is sometimes known as indirect, have actually been around in psychology for well over 50 years. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't till about 2011 that the first murmurs worldwide started to erupt about something amazingly new called compassionately assertive, which had all the best bits of assertiveness, but with less of the edge and less of the forthrightness. And it was just a massive turning point in my personal career and personal life when I thought, oh my goodness, this is it. This is a communication style that I've been looking for. Yeah. And so have so many other people as well.
Okay. So it's really those 4 categories, the passive, the aggressive, the assertive, and then it's the passive aggressive is number 4, correct?
Yeah. So most people would normally fall into one of those. It would be unlikely that people may be 100% of one. They might be 80-20. People often choose for whatever reason. So if an assertive person, for example, chose to be passive momentarily for whatever reason, that's still assertive because they chose it.
So that's really interesting. And that actually dovetails really nicely into the next question that I had for you in terms of thinking about these tipping points and these ratios and the ideal ratios. One of the questions from psychology and just basically from working with humans that I've always found really, really fascinating is thinking about, to what extent can people change? To what extent can people, for example, step out of their personality, step out of their communication style? And so I'm wondering what you were kind of hinting at there is what role this plays here, that if what you just said, that if somebody who's assertive plays the role of passive, it's still assertive because that's how they are.
Mm. It is, right? Because they chose it. Whereas if a straight passive person chooses to be passive most of the time, that is just, that's a choice. That's a choice as well for their communication style. Mm-hmm. So in the, I wrote a book a long time ago, my first ebook, and I actually had a little passage in there that said something like, when the fear of doing nothing is stronger than the fear of change, then you'll go for the change. And that's often what it is. That's often what it is in communication. People just have enough of dealing with people that are undermining them, you know, or nitpicking or whatever. And eventually they will change. So the amazing thing about compassionate assertiveness is, above all else, it provides a learning opportunity for both sides, mm-hmm. in terms of empowerment for the person that might be receiving poor communication incoming, and for the person that's actually giving that person the communication, so they realize that's not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you definitely can. I truly believe that all communication can be, if not corrected, there's a learning opportunity there. So it's all learned from preconditioning or whatever. It can all be unlearned and you can start again. And
yeah,
at any point in your life with any type of relationship.
There's learning opportunities in that if you can become aware of perhaps, say, those kinds of situations where there might be an imbalance and, oh, you know what, maybe there needs to be more assertiveness. Like if you have four passive people trying to make a decision, I'm sure we've all been in those kinds of situations before where, you know, maybe you were one of those passive people or at least playing a passive person at that time. No decision is going to get made and no real sort of forward progress is going to be made. But that if you can kind of learn, to step into that assertive or compassionate assertive role, then that's how we can make change happen. So there's opportunities there for people to take ownership over their own communication.
Absolutely. And I think the problem I had back in 2011 when the first global thoughts emerged about compassionate assertiveness was that a lot of the early thoughts, I studied nonviolent communication for a couple of years, and then some of the early books came out about compassionate assertiveness, but they were based on Buddhist principles and they were really more compassion than assertiveness. So I would read all these early books and early research papers and think, yeah, that's great. I can see that. I can see the compassion side, but where's the learning opportunity if you run on compassion all the time and there's no assertiveness? So what I created back in 2011 was, I believe, the world's first model to bring them both together into something that was truly compassionately assertive. So, and what that looks like in real terms is that would be someone that, they normally start from one simple question. They ask themselves in any human interaction, how does that work for me? And if it doesn't work for them, compassionate, assertive style of communication would make them look for the kindest, easiest, most obvious way to tell the person that it doesn't work for them. Instead of sucking it up, instead of being passive aggressive, it's just a really simple, obvious way to communicate. It is spectacular in terms of getting the job done.
Sure, absolutely. And I think that we can all think of times that perhaps this might have happened by accident or perhaps on purpose as well. I'd love to dive more into this compassionate assertiveness, because there is that balance there, balancing the compassion with the assertiveness. And so you've begun to explain this, and it's definitely resonating with me, and it's awesome. I think what can really take it to the next level is if you could give an example of what, you know, maybe something that you've experienced in your life, somebody that you've worked with, where it was like a difficult situation, and even like the language, like what would compassionately assertive language sound like and look like in a particular situation?
Okay, that's an awesome question. So the first thing to realize when you're kind of embracing this model is that it all hinges on something that I've named the emotional ping. So people get these emotional pings. Some people get them hundreds of times a day. Some people would just get them a couple of times a day. So the emotional ping is what you feel when someone does or says something to you. So sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's not so good. Compassionate assertiveness makes you send that ping back to the person. So there's a learning opportunity. If you don't send it back, then that normally just hangs around in either resentment, judgment, or fear to just be turned around again later. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I would say is, once you've noticed that ping, so that might be if someone says something to you and you don't agree with it, if you think they've slighted you in some way, then that's your opportunity to do something. So compassionate assertiveness works on four simple words, really. If you see it, you say it, and you do it there at the time. So there's no hanging around, there's no kind of saving it up for later. You just go straight into it. So one really good example, and I've had it happen to me before in meetings, and probably you have too, is where someone says something at a meeting and they challenge you on something. So that happened to me the other week in a meeting, and it was about something I said and quantitative data. So something I was trying to prove and prove evidence for what I was saying. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm challenged, you know, if somebody challenges me about something like that, an example for the model would be to just say, so I have the evidence for that. Would you like to see it? Or explain to me why you want the evidence. So the model starts with basically trying to flip the person into figuring out where their headspace is and make them accountable for what they've just said or done to you. And most people don't do that. They never start with the flip. They never start with making the person accountable and getting them into that state of self-analysis. They just kind of let people blurt and take it all on board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. That our knee-jerk reaction is especially in that kind of a situation, can often be, oh, well, okay. Sure. You know, sometimes you don't even know what to say, or you get defensive, or you don't say something or ask something that may actually be helpful in moving the conversation forward. So that's great. The purpose of the flip, would the flip often be a question? That's what I'm thinking would be.
Yes, the flip would often be a question. So an examples that I often use in my classes are things like, you could say to someone, why would you say that? So if they just blurt something out and they're running on ego or their opinion or judgment, you could say, oh, why would you say that, Bob? So, and then just stop talking. You don't put all the twiddly bits on the end that go, because I'll tell you what I think, Bob. I think mm-hmm. that you just stop talking at why would you say that, Bob? Yeah. And putting the name, because obviously you know that I'm into body language as well. It's kind of my first language. So how that would work when I say the Bob is, even as I'm trying to explain it to you in a podcast, my hand is kind of doing this little jab towards the screen. So why would you say that, Bob? And your hand kind of goes out to give them a little jab to get it into their subconscious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could also ask things like, what makes you think that? Where's the evidence for that? Or just a simple why.
Yes.
You could try something like, well, that's one perspective, without any hint of sarcasm. That's an interesting point of view. Do you want to expand on that for me? So there's lots of ways you can flip people into self-analysis.
Yes. People
just don't choose that as their first option. So what I realized is, I experimented for well over 2 years with the different components of the model and which order they needed to be in. And I always came back to the first one, had to be the flip, because otherwise there's no learning opportunity. People just get to say whatever they like to people with no consequence.
Absolutely. So it starts with the flip, and then where does it go from there?
From the flip, if the flip doesn't work, then I would bring in feelings. But what I found is, the more the person is running on ego, and the more opinionated they are when they're into moralization and that kind of thing, the feeling stage isn't always something that I would bring in. The feeling stage is actually designed to get other people to see your point of view, so to get them to understand where you're coming from as well. And a really good example is, quite often I go into businesses where people feel undermined. You know, they've got a gripe with their boss about the way they're told things, the environment that they're told things in. So a good example that I've come up with to explain it to people in workshops is, you might say something like, did you realize, Julie, that you make me feel incompetent when you talk to me in front of people like that? So it's just a way of bringing in the feelings and making the other person understand what it feels like for you. Mm-hmm. Just so they understand where you're coming from. It's a fine line sometimes, because some people will use the feeling stage against you.
Yeah.
Depending on what they're running on. So The model was actually designed so you don't have to go stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four.
Okay.
You kind of assess what's incoming to you and you go, I need to flip you, buddy. I'm going to flip you. You get stage one. And then other times, stage two might be more appropriate to go, ooh, ouch, did you realize how that made me feel when you just said that in front of the whole team?
Okay, so it's not necessarily a progressive thing where it's you go to step one, two, three, four. It's there's these four options, and in that moment, you can decide which tool to pick, one, two, three, or four.
Yeah, absolutely. It took people a long time in the early years of me teaching this for them to realize that it wasn't a linear model, it's a cyclical model. So yes. Depending on what you assess is incoming and the emotional ping that you feel from it, you'll decide where you want to hop on or the model.
Yeah. All right, let's make sure we get the other two because we have flip, which is making people accountable. That's self-analysis, moving people into self-analysis. Then we have the feelings, getting people to see your own point of view. What's number three?
Number three is the consequence. So if you can't flip somebody and make them see or get them to feel how you feel, then often you do have to get to the consequence stage. And again, this is something that more passive people shy away from. And so I thought there's got to be a consequence stage in. So every action has a reaction, or every inaction has an opposite action, if that makes sense. So it's important that people realize if it's not acceptable to you in terms of communication, and you do something about it. So an example I've got from a recent meeting is I advise one of my clients to say, if you continue to do that, and you might put Bob or Julie or whatever the name is on the end. So if you continue to do that, Julie, then the negotiations will end because I will not put up with that behavior. So it's a clear consequence. So it's, again, it's kind of a bit of a subconscious jab. Mm-hmm. If you continue to do that in a calm, low, slow tone, then we'll end these negotiations.
Yeah.
You could also try and give them a choice about the consequence they want. This works really well with kids, by the way.
I was thinking the same exact thing. We're on the same wavelength there. If you don't eat that broccoli, no.
I know. So what'll be the consequence? So
what would be the consequence?
In the early years of my coaching, I did actually coach parents and couples. And this is kind of where I tested out the theories. And it works really well for parents where they go, oh, honey, you didn't actually tidy your room and you agreed to do that, so the consequence will be we can't go to the cinema now. So you know, it's just kind of working through that model. It works for couples. The model is the model. It's just communication at its best. It doesn't matter what context you put it in, it still works.
Sure. So that's the consequence, and there being potentially a relatively strong consequence, like if you can't do that, Julie, then the negotiations will end.
So it's some version of saying to the person, what do you think will happen if I do nothing about this, or if we do nothing about this? And quite often, if you say that to someone, they will self-correct and provide their own consequence. So if someone, say, for example, in the tech industry was, you know, quite often in the tech industry, I've realized that you're waiting on other people to complete the part of the puzzle. I've got a client at the moment who, you know, they've just invented this amazing new thing, but they're at the mercy of other people who are part of the thing. So quite often I've heard this guy say, well, what do you think will happen if I do nothing about that? And then someone will say, well, the delivery to Asia will be held up, or Bob can't do his bit, or so they'll figure out the consequences for themselves often if you ask somebody that question direct.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we have flip, we have feelings, we have consequences. What's option four?
The fourth one is, I call it either choice or surrender. So if you want to use stage four of this model on someone, you've really got to be prepared for the answer. And I remember in the early days of this, I remember being in Wellington, which is a huge city in New Zealand, and a guy standing up in a room full of 400 people and saying, can I just ask why you don't start with number four first? Why don't you just ask everybody what they want and what they think should happen? And the whole room kind of erupted. A few people started laughing. And I said, why do you think I didn't start with number four? Then by himself, he kind of went, oh, well, I guess if people are harsher personality than you, they'd just use it to manipulate you. And
yep.
I said, yeah, it's not a good idea to give people choice at the beginning. you know, you've got to get them to self-analyze first, think about the feelings, think about the consequence, and then hit them with number four if you want to. Mm-hmm. So the question in number four really is, I call it the raw truth. So it's a stage where you've either got a choice. You can say to the person, you're basically saying, okay, I surrender. What do you think should happen? And you might not like the answer that they give you, but at least you know where their headspace is.
Yep.
And then guess what? You can hop back on the cycle wherever you want. So if somebody said, so like your kid might say, well, actually, I don't want a curfew, Mum. I want to just come home at 2 o'clock in the morning. Obviously, that's not going to be acceptable to you. So you're going to take them back to either stage one or stage two and go, well, that's not acceptable. So how do you think that works?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I absolutely hear you when you say, if you throw that out there, you need to be prepared for whatever it is that they're going to say, and be prepared to work with them on that, because they may surprise you with something like, all right, I surrender.
And they often do. Yeah. And in a business sense, it is invaluable where the team is. Quite often I go into teams and I call it firefighting. And I know quite early on when I'm working with a new business, whether I'm firefighting or whether I'm the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. So what I mean by that is, you know, often the conflict and the mismatch of communication styles is really bad. So you do have to do a little reset. And it's not been unheard of for me to do a short exercise that I call the good, the bad and the ugly, where I just take the whole lid off whatever's happening in a team and say, okay, tell me. Dish it up. What's the good, what's the bad, and what's the pure ugly about working in this team? Mm-hmm. And that's the choice and surrender thing. People will tell you. They'll actually tell you the truth. And often the team leader, the boss, the CEO, whoever, it isn't always pretty, but at least they know what they're dealing with then, instead of it being underground and passive aggressive whisperings at the water cooler or speaking to people out of work about it. So it's a good stage, but it's a pretty you know, it's a courageous stage, because Yes. You never know what people are going to tell you if you say to them, okay, I give in, I surrender. What do you think should happen? They could tell you anything. That's right. In terms of couples, in my early years of working with couples, quite often it would mean that couples came to the conclusion that they needed to split up. They, you know, it's not always pretty, but you will get the truth.
Yeah. And often, to flip it to a career kind of situation or a workplace kind of situation, often it's that really hard thing that's staring us in the face, is that thing that we need to do, which often, you know, for example, for managers, maybe firing someone, letting somebody go. I've heard lots of stories about saying, you know, it was really hard for me to fire this person, to let that person go. But I really, after I did it, I realized it would have been better if I did it sooner. And so if you just ask yourself that question, all right, what do I need to do? What needs to happen right now? And it's like that, it's that first thing, it's that hard thing. And so that's
it is. Like, and
it's helpful for self-analysis as well, you know, sort of asking yourself these questions sometimes.
Yeah, it's nearly always the most obvious thing, but the obvious thing in communication is often the hardest thing as well, because it means that you've either got to corrective coach somebody. So a lot of my work is about teaching senior managers and leaders how to corrective coach their team. So not to just accept behavior, which is bringing down the energy level, you know, bringing down the standards or whatever. And that's, you need to operate from a very brave place to do that. What it means essentially is that you're looking for complete transparency in your team or your company. And that's massive for me, the transparency. It comes up in almost every day of my work, okay. You know, where I just sit there and think, oh, wow, if you just had a little bit more transparency and that person felt able to come and talk to you about it, or you corrected that behavior when you see that in front of other people, this wouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50-plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. you can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to genbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's genbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview.
So on that note, let's stick a pin in that. I want to talk about bravery and how we access that bravery. But first, I'd like to thank you for sharing that. Flip, feelings, consequences, surrender. We all have some new communication tools in our tool belt now. But you made an excellent point about the, you know, being able to do this. It's one thing to say, all right, go do this. It's another thing to actually be able to do it. And this relates to another question that I had for you, Steph, which was on your LinkedIn profile, you say all communication lives or dies, thrives or survives on just 3 things: assumption, perception, and ego. Sounds simple, doesn't it? Well, it can be, but it takes work on yourself mostly. So let's talk about what that work on yourself. What is that? What does that look like?
Oh my goodness. Well, first thing is it always starts with you. So, and again, if you could see my body language, I would be just giving you a little jab right now. So when people ask me that question, I say, well, it starts with you, because you're really the only person you've got complete control over. So the work on yourself is about kind of setting yourself free from all those worn out ideas and attitudes that you've gathered along the way, and realizing that you might actually be the source of dis-ease or a burden in somebody else's life because of your communication style. And man, I've done so many years of research on this over those 1200 businesses and 10,000 people, and somewhere about 18 months ago I realized that I really could quantify it down to just those 3 things. Every single thing that goes wrong in communication, in my opinion, is always either about ego, assumption, or perception. Somebody has either been running on ego, they've made an assumption, or they've not checked the perception with the person they're dealing with, and that's where they kind of misalignment with. So I actually see my mission as being refined and honed almost every client I work with now, to try and just cut out the assumption, minimize the ego, and yeah, just free themselves from running on those 3 things, and then pretty much all communication will be great.
Yeah. And tying in the bravery piece of it, which I see it turns up more often as fear of saying these things, fear of coming off in the wrong way when you're assertive, for example, or fear of coming off in the wrong way when you're compassionate. That a lot of our lack of decision making, our lack of forward moving motion and action is because of fear. So how would you see fear kind of playing in here? Is it an ego-based thing, or does it tie into assumption or perception at all?
If the person that is communicating with you is running on ego, it's definitely fear comes in. And I talked about this in a class I did yesterday. I actually threw it out there in a couple of case studies, like how would they deal with certain things. And the answers they gave pretty much show me whether they're running on ego or not, because people that are running on ego would want their point of view to be heard and their opinion, whether it was right or not, whether it was inclusive or collaborative. So there's that fear that they're going to be minimized in some way. They'll lose credibility. Sometimes it's fear of losing their space in the hierarchy. So absolutely, fear comes into ego all the time. Yeah. And what people forget is that while ever they're running on ego, they may not be hearing the best viewpoint. They may not be hearing somebody's viewpoint that has got something that could really be a change maker. Mm. And that's the sad thing for me, that I truly believe that there's someone in most companies that's got the answer to something really critical, but they're never just given this outlet to bring it to the table.
Yeah.
So that's huge. Ego is definitely comes into the fear. And again, with assumption. So even with assumption, my interpretation of assumption is it's when you haven't actually bothered to find out the facts or check the accuracy. And passive people especially are really prone to that. If they don't hear it right the first time, or it's someone that's more dominant than them, they won't do the, okay, hold on a minute, Bob, just to be clear, you expect me to do this by this time. So they fill in the blanks for themselves, they add a little bit of guesswork, they just make, again, assumptions that it will be okay on the day or whatever.
That actually resonates a lot with me right now. I can't get into the actual details because it's just happened to me. But it was basically, I got an email back from someone and it was very surprising because we had had a conversation and the email that this person had sent seemed out of left field. And I was like, oh, where did this come from? But I would peg this person after our conversation today as a passive person. And I think that this person didn't check assumptions. I think that's what it is. Because when I was thinking about how to respond, I was thinking, okay, perhaps we need to talk again. Because perhaps we're not on the same page here. And it could have been that person's, they didn't say, oh, Jen, is this what you're thinking? Or was it that? And that can happen so often.
That's great communication. So that's where the perception comes in. So to me, perception is about when other people have a different reality to you. It's outside of your reality. So you think one thing's happening. And you might think you've delivered clear, concise, and really concrete communication. But the other person's perception, especially if they're more passive than you, might be completely different. Yeah. So the best communication for me, just again, if you see it, you say it, you never leave it. So if you're not sure, do the paraphrasing thing. Do so, just to be clear, Jen, we're meeting at 10 o'clock on Tuesday. Or just to be clear, you expect me to finish that by 10 o'clock, deliver it to your desk in a blue folder. Yeah. And then you give the other person the opportunity to go, yes, that's correct. And there's no, so, but again, whatever you're assuming that something's taking place, you're leaving yourself wide open for the communication to fail.
Absolutely. So I have one more question related to this work on yourself. Me getting into the weeds a little bit, getting into the how. So some people talk about when we say work on ourselves so that we can do better, so that we cannot let these, the stories that we tell ourselves, the limiting beliefs that we might have, you know, to kind of work through them and not have them hold us back. Some people talk about it in terms of rituals or, you know, daily rituals, working on their mindset, stuff like that. When you think about the work on yourself, what kinds of things, like what actual actions are we talking about here? Like journaling or meditating, some of the above, none of the above, what kinds of things do you recommend?
I think, well, in essence, the model I created is really action-based. It's not, I'm into all that. I journal every day. I do all of that for sure. But it's more about the constant reassessment, evaluation, and self-analysis of yourself. So when I'm dealing with people, for example, and at least, again, in a team of 10 or 20, there'll be at least one person that's owned up to anger issues that just gets angry. Mm-hmm. So for those people, I've got a really simple thing. I basically say to them, unless your life's in danger or somebody's life is in danger, I want to be very clear with you, Bob, that if you get angry instead of using your words and great communication, then you failed. You're a failure. So for those people, that is a really good subconscious trigger. I've had it work over and over again where people, every time they get angry and it's unnecessary, they just go, wow, epic fail there, Bob. For passive aggressive people, depending on the length and breadth of their passive aggressiveness, and the mantra for them might be, did I just tell the right person? Or was that just a whinge? So I'm really big on giving people little mantras depending on what the communication issue is I've been sent in to kind of troubleshoot. I'm a troubleshooter eventually. You know, essentially that's what I do often. I go into companies and they say, oh, there's this mismatch between me and so-and-so. What do you think is happening? So yeah, quite often it's about that. It's all about the self-analysis. And hey, even on me, so I follow the pings. So that's why I realized the emotional ping was such a such an interesting thing. Like, my claim to fame is that I haven't actually been shout out loud angry since June 2012. Okay. But that doesn't mean I don't get emotional pings. Like, I was driving along a lakefront yesterday. A guy, I don't know what you call it in the States, but we call it when you cut somebody up, when they come into the traffic flow really, really quickly, give you no time to respond. And wow, that was a ping for me, but not enough that I would have, you know, flicked him the bird or got angry or said something. But yeah. So I just look at those things and go, okay, I can either let that go, or I can let my blood pressure go up, get angry with him, wave my fist at him or whatever. Yeah. So for me, it's more about the work on yourself for people is look at what you're doing, even look at what your body language does. So the minute your volume goes up, you're talking louder, your tone is more sarcastic or whatever, your body language changes exponentially. It becomes choppier, stiffer, louder, wider. So yeah. That's a good clue to me as well. I watch people's body language to see that, to see how they're feeling, depending on what the body language looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I've noticed, and look, this is an ongoing journey for all of us to sort of figure out, you know, how we can be the best communicators, the best leaders, the best people possible. I love this concept of the emotional ping. And one of the things that I've noticed is that there's actually, it's an emotion for sure. But if you really start to become aware of it, you feel it in your body too. And it's different all the time, you know, and you're like an emotional ping, like, I don't know, like I was listening to a song. It was Elton John's song yesterday. And I was listening and I started to feel a tear in my eye because I was just so filled with joy. I love that song, right? Yeah. And it's like you feel it some way, and you can become more aware of it as well. Or it could be negative. Like you feel that, like, I don't know, like maybe your muscles tense up when you get angry. It's like, okay,
yeah,
that's the ping. I can, and like you said, I can choose to like completely get angry and flip somebody the bird and yell at them. Is that going to be helpful? No. You know, what else can I do? So yeah, I'm totally into this whole idea of self-analysis, having mantras, because that's how ultimately we're going to make that change and take ownership for it.
Yeah, and it is. It's just kind of speaking to yourself and saying, so for me personally, because I really have worked on choosing other options apart from anger, and I'd like to believe that I'm never passive aggressive. So it's totally freeing when you get into that world of see it, say it, because, hey, other people don't have to listen to you whinge. It's very destructive to relationships when someone else is sitting there listening to someone going, oh, why didn't you just tell your boss? Why didn't you tell the person that jumped you in the queue? Why didn't you, you know, passive aggressiveness is really destructive across a whole range of work world, personal world. So yeah, my work on myself has been about recognizing when I flip back into one of those modes, and I will just have little mantras to go, wow, really, that was your choice? Why didn't you go and find the person, Steph, and just tell them how they made you feel? Ask them if there was a different alternative. Right. So that's why on my website you'll find a lot of those kind of case studies about people that leave passive aggressive notes on cars and send people texts when they're in the next room. I'm like, oh wow, buddy, just go and find your person and have a chat to them in real time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So many distinctions here. So much that I've learned from you, and that I know that other folks have learned from this conversation today, Steph. So thank you. Thank you so much. We have a little bit of time. We have one more question. Okay. And this is the question that I ask all of my podcast guests, and you can feel free to interpret this however you like. There are no right or wrong answers here. And that question is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Oh my goodness, that is a biggie. It's getting them to see what their own communication style looks like, I think. So everything in communication to me is about transparency. Once you actually take away the things that are hidden or unsaid and get that complete transparency, your whole world just opens up. So I suppose my biggest challenge is getting people to see the transparency, and that they have to work on themselves. because quite often people will go straight to blame and shame. You know, they'll blame someone else. Of course, the reason I'm like that is because my mother was like that, or she treated my father like that, or, well, he's the boss. You know, you can't really say anything to the boss. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, then it's not going to go away. You know, if you don't deal with it, then it doesn't go away. So my thing that I say to people mostly is, when people just give me the excuse or whatever, I say, this is really simple in communication. You either use it, so it is your fault, absolutely. You either choose it, so you choose to say it, flip into anger or whatever, or you enable it. And what I find, my biggest challenge is getting people to realize that whenever there's frustration involved or exasperation, it's probably almost always because they've enabled it. So if you enable it and keep accepting it incoming, then you've invited it in, and it's not going anywhere until you address it. So the biggest challenge for me is, and quite often I write it on the whiteboard when I walk into a room, even before I've introduced myself, and I just put something like, the good news, communication starts and ends with you. The bad news, that's the biggest challenge, getting people to realize that communication always starts and ends with them, and they've got complete control over whether they buy into all that past conditioning and preconceived ideas and assumption, or whether they just own it and open it up. And
and it's a tough pill to swallow, to say, all right, if there's frustration, if there's anger, if there's negativity, if your communication isn't working, then you've enabled it. And that's tough. That's really hard. But if we can kind of maybe, if you remove the ego from it and say, all right, what can I do better? Then that's how we can start to move to a place of actually getting better at communication to start. But then just for me, it's about this lifelong journey of becoming the best version of myself possible. You know, best leader, best coach, best mom, best wife, best person. Mm. And communication is such a huge piece of that.
It's honestly everything you just said, Jen. It's, for me, communication is the key to all of that, because people want to compartmentalize their life into all these different areas, like mom, wife, whatever. The reality is, if you get your communication right, it's right across all areas of your life. Once you've got that, it's kind of a safe place. Once you've opened up to this level of transparency, it really is a safe place where you can actually accept incoming stuff, and the other person feels really confident doing that. I had a meeting the other day, for example, and the guy said, straight away, he shook my hand and he went, got to tell you just one thing, I found a couple of typos on your website. And I went, oh, that's great, because I just updated that. I was kind of doing it on the run. I did it from my phone. Thanks for pointing it out to me. And he said, wow, I wasn't expecting that. And I said, what were you expecting? And he said, well, I was expecting to be a little bit bristly, but I thought I was just helping you out, telling you where the typos were. And I went, mate, you have. So that's coming at it from the no ego perception, but he could have had a completely different response if I wasn't open to kind of getting the incoming as well. So
yes,
that's the challenge, getting people to drop the ego, see things in the spirit they've been given, and see it as a learning opportunity, and always want to be in that zone where you're willing to work on yourself and self-analyze yourself.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more, Steph. It's been a wonderful conversation today. And I'm thinking now, like, I wonder if people were to kind of analyze our conversation and communication styles in this conversation today, and sort of think about that. But really, at the end of the day, it's about each of us doing what it is we need to do to show up. And thank you for being a part of this conversation about communication.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me. It's been an amazing opportunity. Thanks, Jen.
Yeah, you're welcome. Awesome.